even if you're killed along the way,
you're a martyr.
You're a martyr. You're somebody of great status. Right.
Your status,
your
existential state is, you know, raised to that. What you, and it has to do with the fact that you are showing and manifesting your complete obedience and submission to the will of God. Okay? And it's not that kind of browbeating submission, because people people have this idea, and in the West we have this image of God as this kind of browbeating. You know,
it's ridiculous.
The submission is love.
Love.
It's becoming one with your God.
God.
It's, you know, letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
It's entering that paradise which is God Himself. Do you understand? God Himself, you know, paradise is God Himself. It's, you know, being in the present. There are different stages of paradise.
Of course.
I'm not,
of course,
technically speaking.
Yes.
But what it is really, what we're talking about is God Himself.
God Himself.
And when you feel that love, and, you know, that's the highest level, because, you know, this is the goal. You're trying to feel that connection with Allah, the love. And that's what we talk about submission. We're not talking about submission as a slave submitting in the, you know, deep south of the, you know, antebellum, you know.
No, we're not talking about that. This is,
you know, it's not that submission. It's a
pure
complete
love.
Yeah, it's pure. A complete letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
And complete trust and giving it over to Allah.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, thank you very much indeed for your contribution on The Man Who Changed the World. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, may the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Cockatoos in Sydney suburbs have learned a new way to scavenge for food, opening wheelie bins with their beaks and claws. Australian researchers have found out that the parrot family birds are learning the ability from one another. Moreover, the scientists have discovered that cockatoos in different neighborhoods have distinct styles and approaches to pry open the bins. Although the birds opening bin lids seems to be a simple action, it shows a more complex behavior pattern that proves animals can learn, share, and develop subcultures. In some rural areas, online education during the pandemic seems a challenge, as students do not have access to smartphones. In the Indian state of Jharkhand, teachers have come up with an innovative idea to tackle the problem. Turning walls of houses into blackboards is the solution. Under this circumstance, students can learn in the open air while maintaining social distancing. Teachers use loudspeakers to manage the classrooms. Parents welcomed the idea, as most of them could not afford a smartphone and a fine internet connection. They also built platforms for students to sit on while attending classes. There is a famous quote, "One should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity." A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But, he says, his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge. Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Luriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Luriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Luriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Luriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year. In the US, creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy efficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artists, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curving hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the Inverted Dome. The viewing area of the Inverted Dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
French artist has created a huge cardboard installation in the shape of a hanging bridge. The artwork is 18 meters in length and hovers above Rome's Tiber River with the help of three gigantic helium-filled balloons. Olivier, who created the work, was inspired by famous Italian Renaissance architect and sculptor Michelangelo. The Italian master had been tasked with the constructing a bridge on Tiber to connect the gardens of the Villa Farnesina to the Farnese Palace. However, he died before he could complete the venture. Now Michelangelo's mission has been accomplished centuries after his demise by one of his admirers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. The Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely it's an against each other. But at the same time, we think it's in a digital and the nature is quite easy to get merged.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind. animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 24 goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown bush, and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. We called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goat will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water, and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Maybe kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male cub was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Britain's restrictions on travelers from France seem excessive, the French European Affairs Minister Clement Beaune has said, as France attempts to contain rising COVID cases, which stand at less than a third of the daily reported cases in the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Angelique Christophis. The piece is titled, UK's Restrictions on Travellers from France Excessive, Says French Minister. Britain's restrictions on travellers from France seem excessive, the French European Affairs Minister Clement Beaune has said, as France attempts to contain rising COVID cases, which stand at less than a third of the daily reported cases in the United Kingdom. We don't think that the United Kingdom's decisions are totally based on scientific foundations. We find them excessive, Clement Beaune told BFM TV after the United Kingdom decided that visitors would need to quarantine for 10 days after arriving from France amid concern over the beta variant of the coronavirus. French authorities have said the bulk of its cases of the beta variant come from the overseas territories of La Réunion and Mayotte in the Indian Ocean rather than mainland France, where it is not widespread. The French ambassador to the United Kingdom, Catherine Colonna, said in a tweet on Monday that the beta variant represented 9% of cases in France, including its overseas territories, and was in decline. It represents 3% of cases in Paris, she said. Data gleaned from random samples of positive tests showed that beta variant prevalence has actually fallen from about 7% in late April to 2.8% by the end of June in mainland France, according to data published on Monday. Sylvia Richardson, the director of the MRC Biostatistics Unit at the University of Cambridge and president of the Royal Statistical Society, said she started looking into the data when the UK decision on quarantine policy for fully vaccinated travellers returning from France was announced. I had some suspicion that there was some confusion, she said, adding that the British government should have conferred with the French authorities before making their decision. The responses come as France attempts to limit the rapid spread of the more contagious Delta variant of the virus, which has led to a jump in new infections. France reported more than 12,500 new coronavirus cases on Sunday, the third day that the tally was held above 10,000. In the United Kingdom, new daily cases stood at almost 40,000 on Monday, 19th of July. From now on, it's either generalized vaccination or a viral tsunami. There is no alternative, the French government spokesman Gabriel Attal said as Parliament prepared to begin the process to set into law Emmanuel Macron's new health pass. This health pass is designed to pressure people to vaccinate by making it compulsory to have proof of a vaccination or negative test to enter restaurants, shopping centers, long-distance trains, or hospitals. An Ipsos opinion poll last week found 62% of the French people were in favor of a health pass. Hundreds of thousands of people signed up for vaccinations after President Emmanuel Macron unveiled the plans last week. More than 43% of French people have had two doses of the vaccine. About 114,000 people protested on the streets across France on Saturday against the stricter vaccination rules, which include compulsory jabs for healthcare workers and retirement home staff. Some legislators in the French Parliament have received death threats after supporting the new vaccination rules. The Bayonne public prosecutor has launched an arson investigation after a vaccination center was set on fire in Auron in the Pyrenees Atlantique in southwestern France on Saturday night. Firefighters put out the blaze at a tent set up to house a vaccination center. The prosecutor said flammable products had been found nearby. Meanwhile, within 72 hours of the French public learning they would soon need to be vaccinated or tested to go to cafes and restaurants, more than 3 million people had booked appointments and France had broken its vaccination record, administering 800,000 vaccine shots in a single day. At the same time, daily infections driven by more contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus continued to climb, reaching nearly 9,000 on Wednesday, 14th of July, on Bastille Day. About 20,000 demonstrators nationwide protested against what some called a dictatorship. Opinion polls show more than 65% of the French public support for the range of measures unveiled by President Emmanuel Macron on Monday, 12th of July, aimed, in the president's words, not at making vaccinations immediately obligatory for everyone, but at pushing a maximum of you to go and get vaccinated. Critics, however, accuse the French government of discriminating against vaccine skeptics and those who will not be fully inoculated before the rules come into effect, while others say the government is effectively imposing general vaccination by stealth, trampling on individual rights and freedoms. Weight of Chains. Part 5.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s. Surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against this country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with.
Having won the Cold War, and that led, of course, to the breakup of the Soviet Empire, both in the Warsaw Pact and Eastern European countries and within the Soviet Union itself, that has helped contribute to a movement toward democracy.
Former Yugoslavia had an excellent educational system. I'm product of that system, so most of the people from those years, my colleagues, are all over the world, and they're extremely successful. However, what happened after 2001, they simply assumed that whatever was suggested by European Union, they have to implement it regardless of consequences.
I don't think West is enslaving us. I think West is liberating us. International Monetary Fund is liberating us, accepting the terms of the International Monetary Fund are a step forward for Serbia.
The IMF serves the IMF. It doesn't serve any country. The IMF comes in like a vulture. It puts Serbia deeper into debt. That's what it'll do. So the people will be working for the international financial bankers.
This shocked many in international financial institutions and Western corridors of power. Sadly, Dinčić's plan was cut short. Zoran Dinčić was assassinated in March of 2003, and though a Serbian court convicted former paramilitary leader Milorad Ulemeklegija for the murder, the political background behind the assassination was never revealed. The next chosen prime minister, Vojislav Koštunica, continued Serbia's path towards integrations with the West, but he too at one point began to think that he could reduce Serbia's debt and get away with it.
In 2007, at one point, Serbia was in the process of lowering its level of debt.
The Croatian president adores the EU, and that's because joining the EU made Croatia better. I'm sure the intellectuals agree. In a situation where the biggest local shoe companies had formed a cluster called Koštana, slowly reviving the glory days of the old company, here was Dinčić bringing in a foreign company, the Italian Geox, to compete with local companies. Fair enough, one might say. Some healthy competition couldn't hurt. The problem was that unlike the local companies, which received around $2,800 per worker from SIEPA, Geox received over $12,400 per worker from SIEPA. This allowed Geox to snatch up many workers from the local companies which were doing good business, and with them, snatched up the profits as well and took them to Italy. This is Liljana Georgievska from UNIT, an organization that dealt with workers who lost their jobs because their companies went bankrupt following Macedonia's mismanaged privatization process. Macedonia, a former Yugoslav republic, unlike their counterparts in Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, and Montenegro, didn't experience wars or sanctions in the 1990s. The only armed conflict it experienced was in 2001, when Albanian separatists attempted a repeat of the Kosovo scenario. The Macedonians reacted, NATO stopped the Macedonian offensive, and a ceasefire was agreed upon, with Albanians getting many privileges but not allowed to secede. Dozens were killed in the conflicts, and it didn't affect the economy much. Oh, and the country had a very, very low suicide rate. And yet, more and more people were killing themselves in various ways. If you had money, you could buy health. To a certain extent, of course. Most public hospitals were plunged into a severely dysfunctional state, with a very small budget for equipment, supplies, and staff, and with many doctors asking for or accepting bribes to perform even the simplest of medical procedures. For operations that couldn't be performed domestically, patients or their parents were forced to look for donations, while the rich treated themselves to private hospitals and trips to hospitals abroad. One Serbian health minister, Tomica Milosavljević, from Mlađan Dinkić's party, actually went for an operation in Germany himself. Really sends the right message in terms of the people trusting their own healthcare system. Yes, it was a new age. In Serbia, after the fall of Milosevic, the largest opposition party was the Serbian Radical Party. Its leader, Vojislav Šešelj, was locked up by the Hague Tribunal, accused of inducing war crimes through hate speech. This made his party an easy target for the parties that took power after Milosevic. All that the Democrats had to do was to remind everyone that if the radicals took power, we'd all have a replay of the 1990s. And it was working. Until the two main leaders under Vojislav Šešelj, Tomislav Nikolić and Aleksandar Vučić, abandoned the Radical Party.
they formed the Serbian Progressive Party and switched their tune from a pro-Greater Serbia stance to a more Western-friendly stance. Suddenly, it became obvious that their voters weren't so much interested in waging war against Serbia's neighbors as they were fed up with the way the post-Milosevic leaders ran the state. The Progressives won the 2012 elections, forming a ruling coalition with the Socialist Party of Serbia, the party Milosevic had founded. It was revenge for October 5th, 2000. But did anything essentially change? The new economic and finance minister was a familiar character, Mlađan Dinkić. The difference was that the Western so-called foreign investments seemed to have been left in the shadow of a new foreign investor, the United Arab Emirates. After early elections were called in March of 2014, the Serbian Progressive Party won an absolute majority in parliament. Though Mlađan Dinkić was replaced before the election, this time he was definitely out. Was it finally a change of course? The earliest steps of this new government suggested more of the same economic policies that the Democrats imposed after the fall of Milosevic, but with a more aggressive stance. This time, the new Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić openly called it shock therapy. He filled his government with neoliberal so-called experts, which was quickly praised by much of the media. And the belief in democracy was not really shared by Serbians anymore. In the 2014 elections, Serbia witnessed the lowest voter turnout in its history. Did this mean that the people had lost faith in change through elections?
Well, is there a reason to vote? My own view is, yeah, there's a reason to vote, minor reason. That should take you about 5 minutes to pay attention to it, but the real thing that has to be done is to change the circumstances under which any person in office is going to have to make decisions.
To many, there seemed to be no light at the end of the tunnel. As a matter of fact, the light was closer than they thought. U.S. domination of world economic affairs was a reality after the end of the Cold War. But something different happened in 2010. The G20 held a summit in the South Korean capital of Seoul. U.S. presidents had little trouble enforcing their will on others regarding how the world economy should function in the past. But this time, Barack Obama got the cold shoulder. A new agreement was made, the Seoul Development Consensus, which had done away with many aspects of neoliberalism and allowed a larger role for state intervention. Instead of propagating a one-for-all solution imposed on everyone, it postulated that individual developing nations should shape their own economic reforms and policies. The Washington Consensus was officially dead. A multipolar world was rising again, with a group called BRICS, an association of the emerging national economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, challenging the West.
Well, all those countries are obviously countries that at this moment seem to be having a very prosperous future and this changing economic circumstances, and you know, reaching out to them and trying to establish close cooperation with these countries is in every nation's interest, including Serbia.
But what the mainstream media had done was to condition many people in Serbia to hop when they, for example, hear the word Russia and dismissively repeat how the Russians supported Serbia only because of Russia's own interests.
I had many discussions in this regard when a lot of people were telling me, well, but Russia was supporting you because of their own interest, you know? And I said, yes, maybe this is the case. People tend to support other people for the sake of their own interests. But unlike Russia, others were attacking us because of their interests, whilst Russia was supporting us because of their interests. And in that case, I'd rather have someone supporting us for the sake of their own interest than attacking us. And I think it's logical.
Logical indeed. However, the big Western corporations and neoliberal elites weren't ready to give up without a fight.
Propaganda doesn't come marked saying, I'm propaganda. You have to figure out what is. And in fact, anything that's coming from official sources is very likely to be designed to influence or control minds. And anything that comes from elite circles more or less reflects official doctrine.
Awareness comes through education. Change comes through action. But to change things for the better, you need that first step. Many would think that this is impossible, that the Western powers simply wouldn't allow it. But a revolution against neoliberalism happened recently in Europe. The mainstream media just didn't tell you much about it. 5 years of a pure neoliberal regime in Iceland, a country of 320,000 inhabitants, made it the richest in the world.
all of the three state banks were privatized in 2003 and borrowed over $120 billion over 5 years, 10 times the size of Iceland's economy. They created a bubble and everything seemed to be marvelous. But in 2008, Iceland saw its bubble burst. The stock market plunged 90% while unemployment tripled in 6 months. The country's economy collapsed. Iceland needed to restore order, and they decided to find their own way to fix things. Many criticized them for deciding not to follow the neoliberal doctrine, but as Forbes magazine later wrote, Iceland's heavily criticized method to escape veritable economic demise actually did the trick. Forbes also wrote, instead of bailing out banks USA style, the country forgave mortgage debt for the population and completely started over from square one. See, instead of allowing the neoliberal elites and bankers that destroyed the country's economy to get away with it, Iceland actually thought that it might be a cool idea to indict bankers who committed serious financial crimes which made the collapse possible. The government nationalized the banks, paid off loans for consumers, forgave homeowner debt, and threw the offenders in prison. Simply said, Iceland said no to neoliberalism.
We didn't follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western world in the last 30 years. We introduced currency controls, we let the banks fail, we provided support for the poor, we didn't introduce austerity measures of the scale you're seeing here in Europe.
And Iceland bounced back, with its economy quickly growing faster than both the US and European economies. Change isn't impossible. In fact, it's absolutely necessary, not only in the former Yugoslavia, but in countries worldwide. The 2008 financial crisis showed that neoliberalism was a surefire way to instability, vast inequality, and disaster. But for change to be effective, it has to have a course. And I believe that course can be summed up in three crucial measures. Protect your local economy. This means getting rid of neoliberalism. Capitalism should work for the national economy, and this means protecting local industry from subsidized imports, even if it means being criticized by the EU, IMF, the US, and other rich countries. What also needs to be done is to limit foreign investments, while investing in the domestic industry and supporting it, as this is what every country which is rich today did when it was growing and becoming rich. For example, in the 19th century, the United States strictly regulated foreign investment in banking, shipping, mining, and logging, while Japan and Korea severely restricted foreign investment in manufacturing. In Finland, between the 1930s and 1980s, companies with more than 20% foreign ownership were officially classified as dangerous companies. Today, Singapore is also used as an example of a successful economy, but despite its free market image, it has one of the largest public enterprise sectors in the world, producing around 30% of the national income. Public enterprises were also crucial in France, Austria, Norway, and Taiwan. In most Balkan countries, there are many public companies that are losing money and serve as job providers for political party members. But instead of privatizing them, the government should invest in making them profitable for the betterment of society, engaging professional managers to run them for the benefit of the community. Even if it takes time to do so, investing in yourself will always prove beneficial. Create a functioning welfare state. Neoliberalism would want you to think that if someone isn't successful, it's not because the system doesn't work, but it's because that person isn't dedicated and hardworking enough. Though working hard is important, even billionaire Warren Buffett, the most successful investor of the 20th century, admitted that society was responsible for a very significant percentage of what he earned.
If you stick me down in the middle of Bangladesh or Peru or someplace, you'll find out how much, you know, this talent is going to produce in the wrong kind of soil. And, you know, I will be struggling 30 years later.
Nobel Prize-winning economist and social scientist Herbert Simon estimated that social capital is responsible for at least 90% of what people earn in wealthy societies like those of the United States or Northwestern Europe. And by social capital, Simon meant not only natural resources, but more important, the technology and organizational skills in the community and the presence of good government. This also means providing for those who are less fortunate than others, and in doing so, creating a society where welfare, education, and healthcare will provide a more productive environment and higher living standard. If the system is established to keep hardworking people impoverished, it simply has to be changed in the interest of the people. As renowned economist Ha Jun Chang said, a well-designed welfare state can actually encourage people to take chances with their jobs and be more, not less, open to changes. Make protesting a way of life. When you ask an average Serbian what protesting against Milosevic in the 1990s did, odds are he or she will say nothing. In fact, as we all know, the protests eventually did topple Milosevic. So, protesting does work, whether it's through going out on the street, civil disobedience, or public awareness campaigns, if organized well and done with enough conviction. However, if you want a society that continues going forward, changing something once won't do the trick. I'm sorry to say so. Life is a constant struggle, and the prosperous countries are those which have citizens who always try to improve the system. A new generation was rising, one that wasn't tired of protesting in the 1990s, one that was internet savvy and could see their countries and the world through many different perspectives. While the internet was still free, they could express themselves and connect with others. Even though social networks pacified many, some used their advantages to gather momentum. The youth was realizing that governments make decisions in favor of the people only when in fear of the public reaction. A new wave had to form, a loud, strong, and unstoppable wave of change. And to be a part of it, there were only three simple things you had to do. Revolt, network, resist.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
More than 600,000 people in the United States have died so far due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the worst death toll in the world, and Republican strategists have warned that the party may be blamed by its voters if this total keeps climbing with further COVID outbreaks. We now present you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, Republican Governor Says Time to Start Blaming Unvaccinated for Rising Cases. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Republican governor of Alabama has said it is time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks for rising cases of COVID-19 amid concern that months of misinformation over the need and efficacy of vaccines is fueling a resurgence of coronavirus infections in several U.S. states. Kay Ivey said that vaccines are the greatest weapon we have to fight COVID and added that a surge in new cases of the coronavirus in Alabama is due to a reluctance among many people in the state to get inoculated. Only about a third of eligible people in Alabama have got a vaccine shot, one of the lowest rates in the United States. The Alabama governor, Kay Ivey, said, "Folks are supposed to have common sense," adding, "but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the vaccinated folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down." KIV added that nearly all the new hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID-19 are unvaccinated people. She said, "These folks are choosing a horrible lifestyle of self-inflicted pain." The criticism of those who are eligible to be vaccinated and have chosen not to get the vaccine shot, despite vaccines being available, follows a concerted effort among conspiracy theorists and others on social media and conservative media outlets such as Fox News to sow baseless doubt about the safety or need for vaccinations, despite a slew of evidence over their ability to shield people from the worst effects of the coronavirus, including death. Some of these falsehoods have been embraced by elected Republicans, while other senior party members have refused to actively endorse the uptake of vaccines, citing personal choice. Others, such as the Senate Minority Leader and Kentucky Republican, Mitch McConnell, have stated their support for vaccinations all along, though in an understated way and without publicly calling out more boisterous voices seeking to sow doubt. But in Alabama and neighboring Mississippi, reluctance to take the vaccine can be driven by economic factors, as well as politics or simple fear of a new vaccine. But also for many black residents, they struggle to overcome a historical mistrust of the government and the health system because of a history not just of neglect, but of racist medical abuse, such as the decades-long government-sponsored Tuskegee study, where African-American men were coerced into a syphilis experiment. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey's comments recently came as it has emerged that more than 9 out of 10 COVID deaths in the United States are now people who haven't been vaccinated. Nonetheless, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, just 56.2% of eligible Americans have received at least one vaccine dose. Overall, according to an AP-NORC opinion poll, only 51% of Republicans said in mid-June that they had received at least one vaccine dose versus 83% of Democrats. But in recent days, some leading conservatives have started to call for vaccinations following a surge in infections in several states. In Florida, the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, recently pointed to data showing that vast majority of hospitalized COVID-19 patients hadn't received vaccine shots. Ron DeSantis, who recently began selling campaign merchandise mocking face masks and medical experts such as Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leading public health official in the United States and advisor to U.S. President, admitted these vaccines are actually saving lives. The White House, meanwhile, is trying to supposedly push higher rates of vaccination, said that it is beginning to see a slight rise in uptake in some states, such as Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Missouri, and Nevada, where COVID cases are soaring. One doctor in Birmingham, Alabama, has told of how patients dying with COVID have pleaded to be vaccinated, despite it then being too late to do so. The uptick in infections has inundated some hospitals in southern United States, leading to increasing calls for people to take the available vaccine shots. John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana, said on a New Orleans radio show, "The fourth surge is real, and the numbers are quite frightening at the moment." John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, added, "There's no doubt that we're going in the wrong direction, and we're going there in a hurry." More than 600,000 people in the United States have died so far due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the worst death toll in the world, and Republican strategists have warned that the party may be blamed by its voters if this total keeps climbing, with further COVID outbreaks. The GOP pollster, Frank Luntz, said, "I think they've finally realized that if their people aren't vaccinated, they're going to get sick. And if their people aren't vaccinated, they're going to get blamed for COVID outbreaks in the future." But polling of those who are unvaccinated has shown that many have made up their minds not to get the jab.
Around the world with reporters.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him. With all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him is very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages.
The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle,